two.
Good evening, and welcome to Conversations. This evening, we have the pleasure of talking with our guest, Richard Jacobs, an attorney. Dick has a sterling record of helping people, individuals, as well as a multitude of organizations and business. And I must say, his honors and distinctions are amazing. He is listed as a top lawyer, as a super lawyer, and in the best lawyers in America for health care. That's quite an impressive listing, Dick.
Thank you very much.
And we're here tonight to talk about a book that Dick wrote a while ago called Crash Landing, Surviving a Business Crisis. Today, all of these things seem to be occurring at a record pace, but it isn't just today that failures occur. They've happened all along, but Dick had an especially interesting situation when he came upon this bank failure. How did you get involved and come to write the Crash Landing, Dick?
Well, it started back actually when I was in practice, and I and several other businessmen down here in Tampa Bay decided to buy a bank back in the late 70s, and so we actually got involved, and I was on the board of directors, and that's how it all started. And of course, what happened with that particular recession of the early 80s, the bank ultimately failed, and I took a pace back and said, how can all these smart guys, which included myself, I thought, get into so much trouble? How is it that we could fail? We'd been in business, all of us had been in business for a long time. I had a law firm for a number of years. Nobody had ever had a failure, and all of a sudden we failed. So I decided to spend a few years after the Park Bank crash to do some research and try to figure it out. Why is it that such a thing could happen to us?
Failure seems to be everywhere these days, and it affects humans in an incredibly emotional way. But as you look at back and how things occurred, what do you see now that you did not see then?
Well, I think is if you're really digging into it, to what is it that caused the bank to fail, and what is it that caused the business to fail? There were certainly things going on at that time beyond our control, as there are today. You know, there was a recession. The government was fighting inflation, trying to keep interest rates very high in order to hold down inflation. But those were things that were happening. I think what really happened and why the business failed is because it was a management failure, as I look back at it. It was simply that we just didn't see the warning signs, and we wouldn't believe the warning signs that were there. And I think that was the primary reason why we failed, because we sat down, sort of like, you know, the old saying of a frog in water. The water keeps getting hot, and all of a sudden the frog boils, and that's really what happens in a business crisis. We just didn't pay enough attention to the signs early enough to stop the business from getting in trouble.
Do you think there are too many layers in businesses where information doesn't pass through as it might have, where one person may know something and the rest don't, and somehow it's not discussed? What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, that's certainly true. Most businesses do have layers in the sense that middle management passes information up to the senior management and so on, and so you're always getting information from other people, and that can contribute to it, but I really don't believe that is a major issue. I think the major issue is that we don't pay enough attention to what really is happening and don't want to read signs that disagree with our view of the world and what we think is really going on. We just plain simply miss signs.
It's interesting how people can avoid seeing things, and all of a sudden it hits them right in the face.
That's
and
right.
I think that can happen with almost anything. When you have circumstances beyond your control, you had real estate growth and, as you say, high interest rates. All of that, probably that had not happened in a number of years. Is that a correct statement?
Yes. No, that's true. That was... it was a great growth period here in Florida back in the late 70s, early 80s, and then of course the country got really wound up in what everybody thought was an inflationary period.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, those are facts. I mean, the point of it is when you have a business, you run a business, no matter what kind it is, you have to deal with the facts that exist, and you have to react to the facts. And I think as I look back on it, what is clear to me is that we simply just did not do that.
What happened to your, I suppose the best word is, how did you feel when you first got news, and how did other people on the board or your board of directors or the officials at the bank feel? What was the reaction?
Well, if you go back to the early stages of the business, as you say, we were all a group of some very successful people in our community, and we thought we were going to bring community banking to a new level. So we were really caught up in our mission, or you could say our hype, as to what we thought we were going to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And early on, the bank, as do all banks, get inspected by the FDIC. And early on, before there were any really serious problems, the FDIC came in and met with the board and gave us a report, said, you're growing too fast, you've got to pay more attention, you've got to have more regulation as to how you're doing things, and you have to have more control. And I can remember the board meeting. I wasn't at that time in charge of the bank. I was a board member. And,
mm-hmm.
And I can remember that the chairman saying, they're not current. You know, you got a bunch of these regulators, and they really don't know what's going on. And they're not talking about us, because this is not going to happen to us.
In other words, everybody felt that they were on the right track, and the regulators were thinking in an old way, so to speak.
That's right. Basically, that the regulators, these regulators are, you can be very, very egocentric about this. You can say these guys are not high-paid people. They've got a job to do, but they simply don't understand the innovations that we're taking on and what we're doing, and therefore, we paid no attention early on. Didn't believe them. Then, of course, as time went on, then some of us on the board, and then including myself, began to realize maybe what was going on wasn't really what ought to be going on, and we really had a very significant and very emotional board fight, and some board members got removed.
Feelings were going on at that time.
Well, it was very, very, very difficult, because I led a small group of board members which really replaced management, and these guys have been friends for a long time. It's extremely emotional when that goes on, and it's very difficult to do.
It becomes very personal.
That's right. Sure
when
does.
You feel that somebody is attacking you or them, and that's difficult to take.
Very, very difficult to handle, yes.
So what happened following the board meeting? Where did all this go?
Well, what had happened is I again, not realizing the depth of the problem, I went to my law firm, talked to my partners, and I said, hey, look, guys, I need to take a leave of absence for about 6 months to go down to the bank and get things straightened out, and then I'll be back. So that's what I thought was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up I was down there 3 years, and, of course, couldn't change the course of events that had happened. We'd gone too far, and the bank ultimately just failed.
Looking back, is there anything that you might have done then as you think now? In other words, as you see it from this point of view sometime later, is there anything that if you had a bank to run again or started one that you've learned from?
Well, I think, overall, what did I learn from the experience of being down in the bank?
Yeah.
Well, I think first of all, you have to not get caught up in your hype. You have to recognize the fact is that you're not going to see what's really going on if you're looking at life and you're looking at the interpretation of what's going on purely from your own eyes. You have to be able to see, you have to be able to get out of yourself, and you have to listen to people, and you have to pick up the pulse of what's going on beyond the blinders we have on ourselves because of the way we like to look at life.
Yeah.
So I would definitely approach something in a you know, and I think I've learned from that, and I think I do that now. You have to have a much broader vision. You have to listen to other people. You have to really try to get down deep into what's going on within the organization so that you're not caught up in your own hype and then miss all these signs.
In other words, put the ego in the back seat.
That's exactly right.
It's intriguing when I think if a person has never failed, and frankly, everyone fails at something, whether it's a math test in the second grade that you remember for the rest of your life, or college things that happen, I think failure occurs. And the thing is our psyche ready for it, and can it learn to make person a much better person?
Well, that's where you hope to end up. You hope to, you know, the old Ernest Hemingway saying that life breaks everybody, and after it breaks everybody, some are strong at the broken places. So that's where you like to end up. But it's a long emotional drag from any kind of failure, whether it be personal or whether it be business or whatever it is, until you get to the end of the tunnel.
Right.
That's an extremely difficult task.
Can you talk about the 3 years while you were there, the kinds of things that had to be done, or the things you were trying to do to save it?
Well, the first thing is we brought in different management. By that I mean we brought in some very experienced bankers that were not involved in creating the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried to get them to focus on the issues that we had to deal with. We obviously tried to raise some money, and for a long time I thought we were going to be able to do that, but it turned out to be that it was very difficult, because everybody at that moment in life, when you see somebody in trouble, they're looking for bargains, and bargains are not what you need. What you need is capital to help you get going.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those were and we tried to develop a very good relationship, and I think we did, with the regulators to keep them informed as to what we were doing. The biggest thing you have to do in any crisis environment is communicate. You have to be able to communicate with everyone you need to communicate with. You have to communicate with the employees, the people that are doing the work, so that they keep working. Then you have to communicate with your regulators so that they know what's going on, and you don't do something that's going to get you into deeper trouble. Then you have to communicate with the shareholders and the borrowers, and try to keep everybody in line. The biggest single problem, I think, of a person in that environment is to be able to communicate with all the constituencies and try to keep everybody as comfortable with what you're doing as you can.
What about the stress? It must have been massive.
Well, the stress, it was. You know, as I say, when you go through the different stages, the first stage, when you have these warning signs you miss, that's the stage of euphoria where you just plain simply miss things. Then when you get deep into the crisis itself, start to work on it. I frankly thought it was a challenge because when I went down to the bank, I didn't at that early stage realize the whole depth of the thing. And I've always liked challenges, as I think you know, as my hobby in those days was flying airplanes. And so that, you know, flying in bad weather was not something that I really didn't look forward to the challenge of it. But as you get into it, mm-hmm. you realize that in the crisis environment, there are no answers. By that I mean you're living in a very, very muddled environment where the choices are not clear, the answers are not clear, and you really have no control of yourself. There's not only do you not have control over all the environment, you have publicity, which is bounding on you, which gets out of hand and gets bad. Then you have litigation. Then you have criticism of people, and then you have embarrassment because, you know, things aren't going the way you thought they would. So it becomes a desperate environment when you're deep into it. Then after the crisis itself, in the sense that once the business fails, then you have the aftermath, and the aftermath is a long time, and it can be very unpleasant in the case of the bank failure. Actually, litigation stuck around for 8 or 9 years before it was all done.
And
so
were you involved in as a witness or part of the trials at that time?
Well, of course, as a director, you get sued. I mean, so we got sued. All, you know, the board members got sued. Everybody who's involved, the accountants got sued. The law firm got
anybody
sued.
Anybody who was in the bank got sued.
That's right. Anybody who was there who thought could be a source of recovery for somebody gets sued.
Mm-hmm.
And so it that becomes very, very difficult because you're used to, as a business person or as a lawyer who runs a law practice, you're used to having some control over what you do in your environment. So here you are, you're sitting there, you have absolutely no control over anything.
And that becomes, makes, that really kills the body, the strain.
It's extremely emotional, yeah. And the thing about it is, beyond the emotion to you, it affects your entire family, everybody around you. I am fortunate that now, this year, as a matter of fact, I've been married now 57 years, so my wife has
well,
put up with an
awful lot. Well, congratulations. You beat me by 3 years.
Well, anyway, I put my family through an awful, miserable time there for a number of years, and finally, I went to a good friend of mine and who was a psychologist and talked to him because I felt that I didn't know what to do. And he said, you know, he said, stick out your hands. And I stuck out my hands, and he said, that's all you control within the reach of your hands. You can't control everything else. You're going to have to learn to live with it. And then we talked about how you handle your friends around you and what you do with your family. And he says, you strike out at your family because there's nobody else to strike out to. You know,
yes, no one else to talk to. You know, I remember a story I believe was in your book. It stuck with me as we read it. And the book is, we think it's beautifully done. I think it would make a wonderful movie because this is so close to home today. The gentleman who worked for a bank, not the one you're talking about, who lost his job. And he did not tell his family. He was too, you're talking about embarrassment. And he packed his own lunch in his briefcase, dressed in his suit and tie, and went down and sat in a hotel lobby the whole day, and then would come home, and the family knew nothing until he finally, I don't know how long it took, spoke to his family, and they were very supportive. So what he thought might happen was not there. But I think this feeling, for lack of a better word, the macho feeling of so many men, don't you think that has something to do with the emotions and the feeling of loss and failure?
Yeah, I think it's more of a man thing than it is a woman thing. Of course, you know, as I did research afterward and tried to look into the emotions and what causes them and how you live with them, I think it's the idea of this sort of failure is more of a man thing than it is a woman thing, because women tend to have networks of people that they talk to, and they're more willing to talk about their feelings. They're more willing, you know, to get their emotions out and work them out with other people. Men tend to be, they don't do that. They tend to be more loners. They tend to have buddies, but not the friends that women have, and they tend not to want to let down their guard. They tend to want to be more of the, you know, the master of their own universe. And so it's just, I think it's harder on men than it is on women. And I think the research that I did after the bank failed seems to support that men are greater risk takers than women are, and men crash great, you know, more frequently and more difficult.
Was this something that affected health as well?
Well, I was very lucky on that. It didn't affect my health negatively. I continually did work out through the time period, and I
probably very
exercised a lot. And
yeah.
Yeah, and it was. I think that was very good. So I was very fortunate. I did not come through with any negative health problems.
Well, it's great that occurred, because I understand. I believe the statistics were men in their 40s with failure or some terrible thing happening. There are quite a few suicides in that age group. And during periods when things are tough, those numbers seem to go up. And that also, you know, you heard of people in the Depression when neither of us was around, that people were jumping out of windows. It just to end the life would be easier than to face all of the things that happened. I think today, perhaps today, people can face things a little more, but I'm not certain about that. I don't have the statistics, but solving a problem, as you say, can be very rewarding.
And, well, you kind of reminded me of a story. In the sense that I remember going to Washington and visiting with the FDIC and staying at this hotel, and every day in the lobby while I was there, there was this fellow sitting under this tree, all bent over, with a cigar in his mouth, and he just sat there all day long. And finally, I asked the teller whether he was a guest and who he was. I asked the bellboy. He said, "No, he's not a guest here, but he comes in every day and he just sits there." And I said, "Do you know what his background is?" And he said, "Well, he was president of a bank that failed, you know." And I thought about that and I said, "That's just not going to happen to me." And thank goodness it didn't.
Yeah, it's an amazing world. From one, we cannot control anything. And one of our psychologists, who will be on in a few weeks, Dr. Michael Edelstein, does a rational emotive behavior therapy. He's the disciple of Dr. Albert Ellis, and creates 3-minute exercises, which one talks to himself in his head, repeats. You know, if you go into work and somebody looks at you the wrong way, you feel, some people may feel angry, and that anger grows. And these exercises are unbelievably helpful. And we were surprised because when his book came in, Jim and I tried the exercises, and my gosh, they worked. So it's interesting. You have to have, as you say, you have to have people you can go to along the way. And when a family is supportive, you've gone 3/4 of the way for help.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is now that I've been back in the practice for a few years, and obviously as a lawyer you deal with people who find themselves in trouble. And I found that the experience that I had, you know, as painful as it was to go through, has helped me a great deal with clients when they come in, they have a problem. And when I see they have a problem, I tell, it's usually the man that has the problem, not usually the woman, the wife. And I always try to get them to make sure that they talk to their spouses, because that's their best friend through this whole process. Mm-hmm. And if you can keep the emotions at home in the place where they can be supportive of each other as they're going through a crisis, it doesn't matter what kind of crisis it is, and certainly crises occur every day to people, if they can be supportive of each other and they can learn to talk to each other, that helps them tremendously through their process.
Yeah, I noticed in your notes, you talk about Aristotle and the philosophy of man's rational mind, what we want to do, that we're not always rational. How does that fit into this kind of a problem?
Well, I think there is a philosophy that man's rational mind is, and his ability to handle his problems on a rational basis is how you solve problems. In fact, you know, I grew up as a young man on the philosophy called objectivism, which is based on that. It says man has to use his rational mind to solve his problems. If he uses his rational mind, whatever solutions he comes up with are rational. But the truth of the matter is, we rarely make a rational decision in our thinking that we do, but not recognizing that we don't. Really means that we make decisions that blind us to some of the elements that are going around us. So in reality, we put on blinders to our decisions. We don't really make a rational decision. We don't look at the facts first and come to a conclusion. Usually, we kind of figure out what we want to do and look for facts to support us, and that makes us blinds us to what really really is going on. Today, that's kind of called the Lake Wobegon effect, you know, after the radio show out of Minneapolis that says, you know, we're all just better than average if we live in Lake Wobegon. And that's kind of how many of us think about ourselves. And that way of thinking about ourselves means that we just put on blinders. If something disagrees with our view of the universe, we disregard it. We don't pay enough attention to it.
Mm-hmm. I remember when we sent our daughters off to college, and we were living in a town of 4,000 where everybody knows everybody else. And having lived in several states around the country because my husband was involved with the universities, the girls were headed off, one to Georgetown, one to Swarthmore. And we told them, you know everybody here, and these people, you know nothing will harm you. But if you go into Philadelphia or Washington, D.C., you always smile at people. Are you sure you want to do that? It's difficult to say to your child, don't smile at somebody.
Right.
But as you're young women, what do parents think? You know, they're worried about their children. And our older daughter said, you know, I can't do that. I have to smile regardless who it is. I said, well, you better take some karate along the way. I don't think there are any answers, but you talk about blocking emotionally disturbing information. Don't you
right.
think that's pretty common for almost everyone?
Well, I think it is. I think it is. It's beyond just business failure. It deals, if you look at many of the things that go on in our world today, in many of our relationships, I think that's one of the most difficult things is the fact is we don't want to deal with issues that could upset us. I mean, you know, I've read recently of a mountain climber.
Mm-hmm.
Read on his blog on the web of a mountain climber, and he talked about the risks of climbing mountains and how you get so much sunk cost in going up the mountain, you know, and all of a sudden there's some indication a storm's going to come, and you don't want to turn back. You blind yourself to it because the potential of a storm means all that money, all that time, all that effort you spent to get up the mountain doesn't let you get there. We could talk about some of the issues of our climate or changing climate and why people don't want to really recognize signs of changing climate.
What do you think? It's a constant back and forth, but what do you feel about all of that?
In what sense?
In the sense of the facts are out there, and yet people are unwilling to see them.
Well, that's a difficult issue, and I think that I've learned as a result of this experience to have what I would call more peripheral vision. When I look at problems now, I try to walk around them and say, if I were on the other side of this, how would I think and what would I do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would I feel about it? And it's a very difficult task because, like everyone else, I have to admit that I have my feelings, I have my emotions. I was raised in a certain way. I have my own value systems. It may not be exactly the same as yours. So it makes, you know, if you and I were to talk about a problem, we probably wouldn't see it the same way. So I think
know,
we just
it's
have
such fun. It's such fun talking about it and having two points of view.
but you know, what the sad thing is, if you see an example of this very, very simply, go on the web and read anybody's position on anything. It
mm-hmm.
doesn't have to just be politics. It doesn't have to just be climate. It could be anything. And look at the reactions or how people react to whatever the position is on the web. Usually somebody will say, well, he doesn't have all the facts, or somebody says, that's really stupid. You know, and neither one may be correct, but the point of it is, all those reactions are not thoughtful. They're not really digging into the issues. They're not really looking at the issues from a multiple points of view to
in
try
words,
to do the best job.
Nobody's doing any research. They're just saying what they feel.
That's exactly right. And they're as a consequence, you don't make very much progress. You know, you just simply don't make much progress. And what I hope is that I learned out of it. This is that I will take more time to look at the multiple points of view and the multiple sides of an issue.
Is there something here? You know, I don't recall any college courses preparing you for, okay, we're going to have a failure. Here's what you do.
No, I don't. The unfortunate thing is, I think, is experience is the way it's learned. You know, when I wrote the book, I hoped that the lessons that we outlined in the book would be useful to a future generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know the book was used in a couple of college courses, and I, you know, but the point of it is, you look at what happened with the recent business crisis,
yes.
And you wonder, did anybody listen? Did anybody pay any attention? And you can go back and take a look at my generation that had the failures in the early 80s, and I can say, well, did I listen to what happened in the 30s or the 40s? And the answer is, it's very difficult. It seems to be something that we have to learn. We don't get much wisdom from success. We get our wisdom from failure, and that happens to be unfortunate, but I think it's true.
We had an interesting experience. You know, it's the experiences in life that teach you.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is, are you there to learn it?
Right.
And we had a call from some group that brought in students from overseas, and a young lady from Sweden, very beautiful young lady, did not have a home family. That was a place to come for dinner and, you know, be sort of a secondary parent while they're away from home. And so we said we'd be happy to have her join us. And our girls, we all had such a good time that for 25 years we had students coming in, some as old as 32, for a year or two. And the girls grew up sitting at the dinner table talking with people who thought differently. And I can't think of any better education than just sitting across the table.
And listening.
Yes.
And the issue is to listen and not just hear, because there's
mm-hmm.
a difference. You know, we hear a lot of things, and again, if I listen carefully to my secretary today and my wife at night, men don't listen too carefully. But if we listen, if we learn to truly listen, then we can pick up the different points of view, and I think we can control ourselves and make a lot better decisions.
Do you think we gain anything from success?
Well, hopefully we do, yes. You can certainly gain from success if you decide to use it for a good motive. But if it just pumps up your feelings about how you do things and doesn't do anything else, then maybe you don't gain all you can gain or you could have.
I think somewhere I remember a story at a dinner party. Somebody asked Frank Sinatra when he was very young, how much do you think you would like to have? He was just starting to make money, and perhaps he only had a million or two, and he said 5 million. And somebody asked him later, and the figure was higher. And it's interesting how the amount of money seems to be the thing that people talk about, but it's who you are as you go through it. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think that money becomes a game, in the sense that, you know, all the studies that I've ever read and this have shown that once you get beyond a certain level of economic security, the money doesn't really increase your happiness. But I truly believe from the work I do as an attorney with people, and what I see is that folks who really create a lot of wealth, it's a game. It's you could say it's an art form. You could say it's a game, but it certainly isn't. Has nothing to do with needs. It has to do with how they view life and what they're trying to accomplish,
and what they do with the money that they have. As you hear that Mr. Buffett and Mr. Gates are doing now, getting people with huge sums of money to donate a good deal of their money to do good things. Very intriguing.
Well, that's a very intriguing thing, and I'm very glad that he did that. I think that's a great idea if it catches on, because there's a lot of worthy causes that need support, and if the government's not going to be the supporter, we have to have folks with wealth and setting up their foundations and that sort of thing doing the support. I hope that he's making a good statement, and I hope that he gets the message across.
Well, it seems that he has quite a list of people who are already talking about doing that. I understand China would like to emulate it. I just noticed something the other day, but their government is made up in such a way that nobody knows if it'll take off.
Yeah.
I think that the idea of the bank, what was your hope that the bank would do had it not failed? You said you had new ideas.
Well, we had, in those days, we were pioneers in what has become now fairly big private banking. We were probably ahead of our time on it. By private banking means we tried to make a very personalized banking experience, primarily for professionals and community businessmen. You know,
what
we
do you
looked
mean
at,
by
we,
personal?
Well, we sit. You have a banker that sits down with you and kind of deals with all of your issues and works out unique solutions for you.
I see.
Tailored solutions would be the best way to say it. Our feeling was that communities needed community banks to take care of small business and which includes professional practices, and the larger banks, which are going after the Fortune 500 and these kinds of companies, don't really meet the needs of the community. So we try to develop early on what I would call private banking or personalized bank service for local businessmen and professionals, and that was our goal.
It seems to me that sounds like a marvelous idea.
It was.
People would feel a connection.
Yeah, it was a great idea, and I thought we did a lot of things well, but we also didn't pay enough attention to the fact that you can only grow so fast. And you cannot, when you're in a community banking environment, real estate's a big factor for everybody. And then when the market changes and the real estate collapses, you don't have any place to go. And so those were the issues: too fast growth and too much of a concentration in real estate.
What do you think about what's going on today? The numbers of banks that are being closed are quite considerable.
Right.
And are the reasons the same, or do these reasons cross what happened to you? In other words, what do you think any connections may be?
Well, from the best I can tell, is there's still the missing signs. I mean, there's still the lack of attention to the reasons. And in the days we were making loans on real estate, there were individual mortgages. We didn't have the ability to go peddle them on a large scale. What has happened since then is they now package mortgages and they sell them on a large scale. So the theory of that was that it spread the risk, and there may be a few bad loans, but all these good loans offset it. Well, the truth of the matter is there wasn't the careful underwriting and the careful looking at the loan packages. So instead of having a few bad loans, we had a lot of bad loans. So it was a similar idea in the sense that there were issues that should have been more carefully addressed that weren't carefully addressed because of the hype that's associated with growth.
Mm-hmm.
And I this is a personal feeling, and many could disagree with me on this. We hear the fact that there's so-called a lot of there's always greed behind it, and you could say that. I suspect that because of people's interest in money. But my own personal reaction is that it's psychological. There's a lot of emotional feelings about this that give people good feelings about what they're doing, and it's the hype. We're the masters of the universe kind of a hype. We can do no wrong, and it's that challenge. It's like the hunt. I suspect that even if you go back to the man's history, his evolutionary history, you put him back in the past 2-3 million years when he was out on a big hunt. It's the challenge of the hunt. It's not just getting enough food to eat. There's the challenge of the hunt. And I think that hasn't gone away. That's still there. And that blinds us to look carefully as to what's going on. I've seen as a lawyer now a lot of these mortgages that have been bought, and they try to foreclose on them. They can't foreclose on them because nobody knows where the mortgage is.
How is that possible?
I don't know how it's possible, but it's what's happened. I mean, I've seen banks totally stymied in their ability to foreclose because nobody knows where the documents are, the original documents. They've got copies, but they don't have the originals. And so what happened? How did this happen? Nobody's paying attention to the details or what they really need to do to make the whole thing work.
Very, very intriguing. What about while you were with the bank? And please let me remind our audience that the book is Crash Landing, Surviving a Business Crisis, and it's an absolutely wonderful book. The idea of the people who were working at the bank, were they the same people who had been there for the good years as well as the bad?
Well, once we once we had the boardroom fight, which was really a fight, and we replaced some of the very senior managers. We just simply had to replace them. We brought in new people, so the staff as a whole was there, but I would say the managers were not, the loan officer managers were not there.
I see. So you had new employees for the last 3 years, relatively?
That would be correct, yes. We brought in, we brought in some very good people, but it was just, you know, one of the difficult things is when you start to fall off a cliff and you don't have a parachute, there's not too much you can do. But it's hard to recognize when you're going over the cliff. So,
It's a very intriguing situation when I think even children, if you look at children who go home, and parents may not be home because today you have two parents working in order to pay for a house that may be more expensive than they really can afford, so it requires two people at work. And the children go home, and sometimes they have to whip up their own dinner in the microwave or whatever. And I think the loss of human connection, while it's different than a bank failing, I think children need to have a bond that they can carry through life where they sat at a table and had dinner and could talk to their parent or their parents about what happened that day. It's like releasing all of the things that are in their head. It clears the head. Don't you think that is something in business that needs to happen as well?
It would be nice if it did. I do think that is a problem in society today. You know, quite obviously my kids are now grown. They're not young kids at home anymore. But you know, from what I understand from talking to the lawyers and other folks that have young kids, I mean, everybody texts and nobody talks.
Yes.
And I think that's a problem. I think it's a problem in communication and business because most of our communications today with clients, they don't come in and talk anymore. They send you an email, you send them back an email, and you have this quick instant answer. But the instant answer is not really the correct answer because you're not able to get into the depth of it or the emotions that surround it or all the facts. And sometimes you got to say, stop, just come on in, let's talk this over.
It intrigues me when people get together. There's always conversation. We had a group of engineers who were friends of ours when we were at the University of in Montana in Bozeman. And we would meet for dinner once a month, and some very brilliant people and very nice. And it was one gentleman would truly not speak. Everyone else was quite open. And one evening, 2 years later, Don started to talk, and everybody was in shock. He just became another person. So I'm not sure whether he had studied Buddhism or whatever, but we all got such a kick out of it. Where was he for 2 years? Somehow he felt more comfortable with those people. And so I do think that talking about things can make life far more pleasant and get feelings out in the open instead of carrying them along to get more and more difficult through the day.
Yeah, and as I said earlier, and I think this is literally true, that women are better talkers and better problem solvers by talking than men are.
Have you ever been in a woman's beauty parlor?
No, I haven't.
I read somewhere that, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, many years ago, they listed businesses that would never fail. And beauty shop was at the top of the list because no woman could stand it if she didn't feel she looked her best and had somebody to talk to. So I don't know anything about men's barbershops, but I suspect maybe that's true there too. Now, you have some thoughts about following goals and the relationship between business leaders and the rest of the crew that was in crisis. What did you discover in your research about how this could be helped?
Well, you know, one of the things is once we got involved in the bank and started to operate the bank, the natural feeling is my main concern was, would the key people that we needed to try to turn things around, would they stick? Would they continue to work? You know, would they be there? So. And they, most of them stayed. Most everybody stayed. I didn't lose hardly any critical people. And I, in that sense, I was lucky because I certainly didn't have any any deep understanding of why that occurred. But
this is quite a compliment.
And
probably they were comfortable there, and it was not easy to leave either.
Well, I think they were. I think they were challenged. But I think as I spent the 3 or 4 years after the bank failed and in trying to understand leadership and how leadership works, I think what I concluded is that there has to be a very close linkage. By that, I mean, it's an emotional linkage between I'll call them the followers and the leader. There has to be a linkage so that each finds, and I don't think they do this objectively. I think it is very subjective. They each have to find a reason to be together and keep going this way. So what there develops an emotional bond and you know, Viktor Frankl said many, many years ago that men live by looking to the future. And I think if the leader can convey and communicate to the people that are following that there is some future there, no matter how desperate or difficult it is, that they can link to, then they find a way to stay together. There were two particular lives which have nothing to do with banking that I studied afterward, which really helped me understand this. And one was Lawrence of Arabia and what he did in World War I, and the other was actually Moses in Exodus. Because if you look at Moses, he was a man who was very spiritual and had was after deliverance. I mean, his idea was to deliver the Jewish people from Egypt. But if you look at, if you read Exodus carefully, you realize that the people that were following him and stuck with him were more interested in really in the milk and honey. In other words, they had more short-term objectives than he did, but they linked together and they were able to stay together and accomplish what was accomplished. There was this dualism between leadership and followership. Same way in Lawrence of Arabia, here he was a British officer in the desert who got these Arabs tribes to fight on the side of the British, and he led them, and he essentially became an Arab. By the way in which he did, he linked with them, and they became emotionally bonded. And my study of those two lives really helped me understand how you link with people. In fact, it became so important to us that Joni, my wife, and I ended up taking a camel safari in the Wadi Rum, where Lawrence of Arabia did his fighting, and went tour down the Wadi Musa, where Moses was. So we had
that
to go see it.
That must have been quite a trip.
It was. Very, very good trip.
And I understand you are also a photographer, a naturalist. And
well,
what got you involved in these things along the way while you've been in law now for a number of years?
Well, I was always had an interest in photography. I mean, I've always had an interest in nature photography. And as I got into it, I realized how important it is to have an understanding of ecology and what's going on, and then try to really try to do something to help the world keep going on a positive vein. So my interest in photography got me into ecology, which has gotten me into really being interested in, I guess you would say, a photographic naturalist.
Mm-hmm. Well, your photographs, I looked at some of them. They're beautiful.
Thank you.
And the whole idea of business as related to your current hobbies seem to have a strong feeling of the self. And I suspect that was made stronger after you went through this, or am I wrong?
I'm not sure I totally understand your question.
That failure brings who we are to the fore.
Yes.
I think
the whole thing is, as I said earlier on, is that, you know, like Ernest Hemingway said, the world breaks everyone, and afterwards some are strong at the broken places. And I think you have to have in your mind that's where you want to end up. You want to end up stronger at the broken places. And I think I've been fairly fortunate in that regard. And I think it certainly made me a better lawyer, because now when I'm able to talk to people, because I've been through the kind of problems they have, and I can understand them, and I can help them deal not just with the legal issue, but with the personal issues, and that's really the ultimate. Oftentimes, you can't really solve a legal problem totally, but if you can help the person get through the problem so he's not destroyed in the process emotionally, then I think you've done a very good job. And I think having gone through this process myself, that's probably the biggest lesson I've learned and what I try to concentrate on.
In a sense, it was therapy itself.
I think it was. Yes, it was.
It's an interesting world we live in.
Yeah.
The writing of the book came when? It was it directly after this happened, or was it sometime afterwards?
The bank failed on Valentine's Day in 1986. I always call that my own personal Valentine's Day massacre. But
right.
I actually started writing. I started doing some research about a year later. I mean, the first year was just too emotional, and I just decided I have to figure out what's going on. So I started doing the research a year later, and I probably just read and made notes and research for over three years, and the book was actually published in 1991, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was a major book club pick too at that time.
Yes, it was. So it was 19. It was 5 years later that the book was actually published. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, did it change your law practice and what you were practicing?
No, it didn't change the fundamentals of what I do. I'm still fundamentally a business lawyer. I'm not a litigator. I'm on the business side and I represent a lot of professional practices and always have.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of personal planning. And so it didn't change what I do, but it changed definitely the way I approach what I do and the solutions that I come up with. They're I think far more practical, and as I say, I'm more concerned about keeping the person from going off the deep edge as much as anything else. And I think, you know, that wasn't a concern of mine before. In other words, you know, a person can come in to see you about a problem and he asks a question and you try to answer the question. But the truth is now I look as to what is the real question behind the question. In other words, what is he really asking? Because most of us don't speak what's really on our mind. So I try to get into that now.
How long did it? I know the pain is probably still there because you never forget those things, although it tends to pale as time goes on. But I'm sure you recall moments in the years that have occurred.
Well, you don't ever forget it. That's for sure. I would say the last, it's been quite a while. I would say when the book was published in 1991, I thought all the litigation was over with. In fact, there's an epilogue in the book which kind of brought everything up to date as to where it was at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lingering lawsuit that I had honestly had forgotten about that stuck around another 3 or 4 years. So it was really the mid-90s before everything was gone. And I was able then to get back and to start to really rebuild. And the first time, when I first went back to work after the bank failed, when I went back into the work, it was very difficult. I mean, I had no energy.
You were drained.
I was drained out, yeah. And I just could not deal with issues. So that took a long time, and writing the book helped a great deal in that sense. It allowed me to get out of myself.
Yeah, that's true. You know, when people say, I'd like to write a book, what do I do? And when somebody calls you up with that question as a publisher, you say, what can you say? But generally, we tell everybody to write one sentence. Keep a little journal and write one sentence, because it's hard to write. And then maybe in a month you can write two sentences. And then go back and reread what you've written. Does it make sense? Did you like it? Are you feeling that you want to do more of this? I think writing a book may be man's greatest desire, at least from the hundreds of manuscripts we see every month here.
Yeah,
it's interesting, and now you know that anybody can publish a book, even though nobody knows whether the quality of the book, but that's for society to decide. But some of the greatest pleasures a person can have is to sit down and read a book and take something from it so that their life is a better life. And there's so many wonderful books, and I count yours among them because it was so well done. And even if it was a catharsis, you have a gift that not everybody has.
Well, thank
you. So it's a delight talking to you, and we'll talk soon again, I'm sure. And we thank you for being our guest. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you, Mary. Enjoy the talk.
You're most welcome.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And good night to everybody. We enjoyed being with you, and we look forward to seeing you next Wednesday when our guest will be Dr. Tom Anastasi. We'll see you then. Thanks so much.